From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, a closet that tells the story of a woman's life. A woman who grew up in a shtetl in Eastern Europe, fled with the family to what was then Palestine, and eventually moved to New York. Sarah Berman's closet and her life are the subjects of a new book and a museum show created by her daughter, the children's book author and illustrator Myra Kalman, and Myra's son, designer Alex Kalman.
Yes, she ironed her underpants and her socks.
And we remember Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and historian Tony Horowitz, who died Monday at age 60. We'll listen back to our 1998 interview recorded after the publication of his bestseller, Confederates in the Attic, about how the Civil War lives on in America. And we'll hear Maureen Corrigan's review of his new book, Spying on the South, which was published just 2 weeks before his death. It's a long way from a shtetl in Eastern Europe to an apartment in Greenwich Village, in miles and in the shape of daily life. That's the story told in the new book, Sarah Berman's Closet, a collaboration between children's book author and illustrator Myra Kalman and her son Alex Kalman, a designer and founder of the exhibition space called Museum. Sarah was Myra's mother and Alex's grandmother. The book is also about how after 38 years of marriage, Sarah left her husband, they were living in Tel Aviv at the time, and also left behind all her possessions with the exception of what she could fit in one suitcase. After starting her new life in Manhattan, she decided to wear only white. Her immaculate, ordered, all-white closet is not only referred to in the title of the new book, it was turned into a museum show. Sarah Berman's Closet was on exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and is now at the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia, along with an expanded version of the book with artwork, photos, and objects from Sarah's life. Myra Kalman, Alex Kalman, welcome to Fresh Air. So, Myra, the way you've written the book, it's almost like you're telling your mother's story from going to a village in Belarus to Palestine to Manhattan as if it was a fairy tale. You write children's books, but this one, I have to say, it reads kind of like a fairy tale. Was that intentional?
The nature of the family and the stories that came from Belarus and the stories that came from Palestine always felt like a fairy tale. They were absurd and they were strange and they were terse and irreverent. And I think that when we were writing the book, when Alex and I were writing the book, we knew that that was the tone because it felt that was the natural tone of how our family spoke.
Did she ever explain to you why she started to wear only white?
No, and that was the beautiful part of our life. Nobody explained anything to anybody. There was a tremendous amount.
And we knew not to ask why.
And we knew not to ask why, but not out of fear, just out of it didn't matter. You know, we just all went along with things as they happened. And I guess that's part of the fairy tale aspect, that you don't really ask why.
Okay, so you have this like lovely spin on all of it, that it's like a fairy tale and it's everything is beautiful and ironed and starched. Even the socks and the underpants are ironed. And as an outsider from afar, I could have put a really negative spin on all of this and said, oh, this is a sign of some kind of obsessive compulsive disorder and a sign of a kind of narrowing of her world, that she narrowed her world to only white, that everything had to be so carefully controlled because she was afraid of chaos, as opposed to that she loved order and precision. Did you ever think of like the flip side, a possible dark side, to the beauty that you found in her closet?
Never. I mean, she had enough darkness in her marriage. It wasn't as if her life was this beautiful fairy tale. She really had a tremendous amount of sorrow and conflict. But when she started her own life again in New York, it was all about the nature of the love of your life and the love of what you can do in your life and how you make your own decisions and beauty and the aesthetic of all of it. That was really an important part of it. So it wasn't about control so much as about an expression of joy.
And what made you think after your mother died, and Alex after your grandmother died, that her closet should be preserved in some way as a work of art?
It actually began before she died, when I was a child, we would go over to her house for dinner on Friday nights and other times as well whenever we were invited. And we would appreciate her closet like a masterpiece of art while she was still alive. It was already something that was so powerful and communicative and beautiful to us. So it started then, this appreciation. After she died, Myra said, let's preserve this space. We can invite, we can open it up to the public. People can pay what?
50 cents or a dollar, I wasn't sure.
and come and visit.
Yeah, and I assigned my sister as the docent.
So what were you going to use as the exhibition space?
Her apartment.
The apartment.
We were just going to keep it. And my sister, you know, in my mind, my sister would be sitting there waiting for people from all over the world to appear.
I bet your sister just loved that idea.
She was the, yeah, she had some thoughts about that.
So
it was plan B, which is keep everything and wait and see what happens, because one day this will be. There was no question about it. We just didn't know how it would reveal itself until Alex's museum, and that was the brilliant moment of life.
So, Alex, describe your museum, which is pretty unique.
There's a small alley called Cortland Alley just below Canal Street in Lower Manhattan, and it's a kind of a gritty, graffiti-covered alley. And in the alley, there are two small spaces, one a former freight elevator shaft and the other the back of a store. And both of those have been converted into exhibition spaces that make up the two wings of Museum, which is the museum that I opened with a couple of friends in 2012. Museum is spelt normally, except that it has an extra M on either end. So it's MMUSEUMM. And it's really a style of storytelling, a look at the human condition, a look at who we are and how we feel and what we're dealing with and what we want and what we hope for and what we're afraid of, through vernacular objects, through objects from around the world that reveal these kind of elemental truths about what does it mean to be alive in this day and age. So I think about it almost as a form of journalism through objects.
So the book and the larger exhibition, which is now at the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia, also tells the story of Sarah Berman's life. And I think you both went back to the village where she was born in Belarus, a village called Lenin.
I wasn't invited on that trip.
Oh, you weren't invited?
Why
not?
Yeah, I don't think you were. I don't know why. We forgot about So there were some people we forgot about. It was more of a cousins, like the elders. The elders of the family went.
Mm-hmm. So describe what you know about the village when your mother lived there, because I think her story is probably very similar to the stories of many Jewish people who grew up in that region and then fled the pogroms.
You know, one of the things that we talk about at the museum, the National Museum of American Jewish History, is the swath of history that her life mirrors and or parallels. And so the shtetls of Eastern Europe, where everybody's in, all the Jews are in a little village, there's a curfew. They have a very limited life, and it's very constrained. The pogroms go on, of course, the wars go on. The borders change from Russia to Poland, and they're controlled by different people, but always they're the Jews in the shtetl. So, of course, Zionism appears and becomes a and Palestine becomes a magnet for the Jews to survive. So they left in 1932, and they left a village that was, you know, shacks, really. And when we went back to visit, a lot of the shacks are still there, except now people live in them who have computers. And you look at it and you say, how did you get this shack? Where did that happen that my family left and your family lives there now? And it looks very ramshackle because, you know, it's all the same except for just one tiny difference. There are no more Jews. So the intensity of that visit, you know, I collected water from the River Sluch where she almost drowned and looked at the land and then said, this was a trip of what is no longer there. And so the intensity of Palestine and Israel is many times stronger because you can see the desperation of what, and the mass graves and the mass cemeteries, and you say, this is, there was no choice, of course. So it's incredibly moving and harrowing in many ways to go back.
So you both write in the book regarding the village, the shtetl, the men were fine, but the women were wondrous. They took care of everything and everyone, and that was a lot. What do you know about what women's lives were like in the shtetl where Sarah grew up?
It was a life of endless toil, and which was reproduced in Israel, so it wasn't hard for me to see that when I was a child, and when we were in Israel over the years growing up, and Alex was there too, that the women's job was to take care of the home and the family in all of its extreme moments of care, making the clothes, washing the clothes, on the, you know, bringing them up to the roof to dry, making three meals a day, baking on Friday, serving the men who never, ever, ever did anything in the house at all, ever. So theirs was a constant level of work. And I always think of it as silent toil, you know, that you're so busy churning and cooking and cleaning that you don't have time for conversation. But at some point, you sit down and you have a glass of tea. And then you can talk to each other. And all the years that my parents were living in the United States, my aunt Shoshana and my mother Sarah wrote to each other every week. So there was a ritual. In Tel Aviv, they would sit in the kitchen and read the letter my mother sent, my cousins and my aunt. And in New York, we would sit in the kitchen and read the letter that Shoshana sent. And by the way, they never complained. It wasn't like I would be, you know, I don't think every woman in Israel was doing what they were doing, but they had a real level of we call it, you know, over-devotion. And what does that mean? What is that lesson that it teaches you when you see women being so over-devoted? It's a high bar, and it's also a bar that you may not even want to think of, you know, to replicate. But it's all about love, and I think that's the underpinning of it, in our family anyway.
Do you think that the meaning of being Jewish changed in each home that your mother lived in, first in the shtetl in Belarus, then in Palestine, then in Manhattan?
There was definitely a shedding of ritual. And even though they, you know, so in you know, actually in the shtetl, they were, I'm sure they were kosher, though I don't know how they managed that. But my grandfather was devout, and so they were religious, and they lit the Shabbat candles and did and prayers and observed the Sabbath. Palestine and Israel, a little bit less. Yes, they were still kosher, but maybe they didn't light the candles on Friday. New York, all hell broke loose. Shrimp cocktails, here we come. And I think that you know, that mirrors a sense, you know, a development in a sense like, yes, we're Jewish, of course, and we have a cultural affinity that we'll never be able to break, no matter if we wanted to or not. But following, observing the rules certainly lessened, and those were big moments.
Alex, when you were growing up, were you able to communicate with your grandmother? It sounds like she was not much of a talker and didn't reveal very much about her life. But I think, you know, for a lot of Jewish children who are growing up, their grandparents were either unable or unwilling to communicate what it was like and what they would often describe as the old country. So I'm wondering, like, how distant did the Belarus part of your grandmother's life seem to you? And how much of a grasp of it did you have?
I knew that there was a time and a space in her life that I didn't fully understand or didn't feel connected with. But we also, I don't think that that was a kind of a lack of communication. I think that it was a focus on the present moment and the time that we have together and the joy of this time and wanting to celebrate that. And her not feeling she needed me to have a deep understanding of the history, to have some sense, but that the feeling of love and play in the time that we had together was much more of a priority. We were incredibly close until she died when I was about 19 years old.
You write that her end had come in a whisper. She died. It sounds like she died in her sleep, visiting her sister in Israel.
We were all together in Tel Aviv for the High Holidays, all of us, Alex and Lulu, my sister Kika, and we were all staying at a hotel, and we spoke in the morning and said, see you at breakfast. And we were waiting, and she didn't come down. So clearly from the time she spoke on the phone till the time she was getting ready, she had a stroke, and she just crumpled on the floor, and that's how we found her.
How old was she?
She was 84.
And the night before, she had been singing songs and toasting the family and sitting under the stars, being as happy as one could possibly be with her sister and the family around. And the photographs from the book, from that part of the story, are stills from footage that I was filming of her on that last trip, not knowing that these would become the images of her last night or the image of the beach the next morning without her.
Do you take some comfort in knowing that she didn't go through a long period of suffering, as many people do know?
I mean, we call it the death of angels, because because you're spared all of that. And everybody, you know, people who hear that say, oh, that should be me, that should be my end. I don't know. I mean, sometimes Tibor was sick for 5 years, and
your late husband, yeah.
Yeah, and that was really horrific. But there were good things that happened along the way, too, though right now I can't remember them. But whatever. So, whatever, there it is, whatever life gives you.
Myra, do you think a lot about how the women in the shtetl where your mother grew up, that they toiled, as you put it, that they silently toiled like all day and all night, preparing the food, doing the cleaning, doing, you know, the washing of the clothes, doing everything that pertained to sustenance and care of the house and the people in it. And you and now Alex as well have devoted your lives to making art. I mean, it's just such a difference. Like, the women in your mother's village could not have afforded to spend a lot of time making art. They had to just, like, take care of making sure there was food on the table and clothes to wear.
I don't know. There's an inevitability of what happened to us, but there was also a kind, well, I mean, there are many things that happened, but one of them is an allergy to patriarchy. And I have to say that I am crazily allergic to any man controlling a situation. And I think that growing out of that meant you have to have your own income. And growing out of that is, how do you forge your own identity and how do you forge your own career? So one thing certainly was connected. And my mother, one of the few things she said to me was, you really have to have your own identity, your own money and your own work. I think more so actually your own money. It equates with freedom for many, many women, especially who had no choice. She couldn't leave my father because where would she go and what would she do? So of course this isn't every woman's story by any means, but it showed me how important it was to really forge your own work and never to give up on it, really never to give up.
And the situation for you was that your husband died when he was 49 and you were on your own with two children to raise. And so it's really lucky that you had an identity and work to carry on with.
It was extraordinary. Tibor and I met when we were 19 in summer flunk out school at NYU. And one of the things that we found very quickly was that we could collaborate, and we had a kind of communication that my parents never had, and we worked together. And he was always extremely aggressive about pursuing your work, and for me too. So I was really fortunate in that I had a type A maniac workaholic person as my mentor, in a way, as my colleague and lover and husband and friend. And I understood what it meant that how important it was to work.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Myra and Alex Kalman are the authors of the new illustrated book, Sarah Berman's Closet. Their museum show of the same name is now at the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia. After a short break, we'll remember journalist Tony Horwitz, who died Monday at age 60. We'll listen back to our interview recorded after the publication of his book, Confederates in the Attic, Dispatches from the Unfinished Civil War. And we'll hear Maureen Corrigan's review of his new book, Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Vrbo. Finding the perfect vacation home is hard. You start off looking for a beach house big enough for six and wind up watching videos of surfing dogs. Vrbo does the hard work for you. Whatever your budget or what you want from the home, a yard, grill, or even a private pool, Vrbo's got you covered. Download the Vrbo app, V-R-B-O, to discover everything from condos and cabins to villas and castles. Let Vrbo find a home that matches you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author Tony Horwitz died Monday, unexpectedly, at the age of 60. He was in the middle of a book tour promoting his book Spying on the South. He's survived by his wife, the journalist Geraldine Brooks, and their two sons. Before becoming a full-time author, Tony Horwitz covered wars and conflicts in Northern Ireland, Bosnia, and Iraq for the Wall Street Journal. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1995 for his stories about working conditions in low-wage America. I interviewed Tony Horwitz in 1998 about his bestseller, Confederates in the Attic, Dispatches from the Unfinished Civil War. At the time, he was covering the South for the Wall Street Journal. The book chronicled the obsession that thousands of Americans have with the Civil War, dressing up in Confederate or Union uniforms and reenacting famous Civil War battles. He spent time with reenactors and traveled around the country to examine the legacy of the Civil War. Here's an excerpt of our 1998 interview.
Tony, give us an overview about the kind of reenactments that happen now in the South.
Well, it's not just in the South. They do reenactments everywhere now, even in California and even overseas. And in Germany, I met a German reenactor who's started a unit over there. So this is really a global phenomenon. But basically, between about now and fall, which is when most Civil War combat occurred, there will be every weekend, particularly in Virginia, reenactments of battles. Typically, they try and time them for the anniversaries of that battle, where, you know, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people will come out and put on uniforms and shoot blanks. One of the surprises to me about this is that so many women are involved, and that, in fact, the growth area of reenacting is among women who play civilian roles, nurses, laundresses. You even see embalmers. And some women also play soldiers, of course. But this is much more than you know, men going out and playing boy for the day and going, bang, bang, you're dead.
We should say here that reenactment is a word that a lot of the people who participate in these restaged wars really hate. Why do they hate it?
Well, the ones who hate it the most are called hardcores, and this was a particular group that I hooked up with in my book. They believe in trying to achieve total authenticity, and in their view, really even reenacting battles is phony because, of course, no bullets are flying. So what they do instead, for instance, is they'll have a weekend where they play Union and Confederate sentries on either side of a frozen river, and they'll sit there all weekend, and maybe once in the weekend, one of them will say, hey, Yank, want to trade some coffee for some of this fine Southern tobacco? And that'll be it. They'll be, you know, trying to reenact the war as it really happened. A lot of marching, a lot of sitting around. They'll only eat the foods that soldiers would have eaten. They'll only use the language that soldiers, you know, would use. In a sense, they'd say, we're not reenacting. We're living it. We're living historians.
Why relive that? Why? What are they getting out of reliving the boredom and the hardship?
Right. I think part of it is a kind of guilt almost about how easy life is in the late 20th century. You know, I guess the draft ended in about 72. For men like myself under the age of about 42 or 43, other than those who served in the Gulf War, we're really among the first generation, really, in this century to not have to go off to war or serve in the military. And I think there's, because of that, there's perhaps some guilt, but also some romanticization of this experience. We heard about it from our fathers and our grandfathers. And I have to suspect that if a few more of these folks had served in Vietnam, for instance, they may not be so keen to reenact their military experience.
Now, you did go to a huge reenactment of the Battle of the Wilderness,
right,
which was fought in 1864. Tell us about the original battle, and then we'll find out more about the reenactment.
Right. Well, the original battle was really one of the most horrible in the war. It was when Grant took over in the East, and his idea really was to just wear down the South and use the North's superiority in numbers to fight battle after battle. And the Wilderness was the first of that campaign, and it was fought in a really very jungly wood in central Virginia, hence the name Wilderness. It was really a draw, but with immense casualties, 25,000, 30,000 casualties in the course of 2 days. The woods caught on fire and burned some of the wounded. There were hogs feasting on the dead. It was really a very grisly battle.
And what's the reenactment like? How many people showed up when you were there?
Thousands. It was quite a large reenactment. One of the interesting things to me is it's all sort of signposted. You drive and it'll say, Battle of the Wilderness this way, and Confederate parking lot over here, and which of course wasn't the case in the Wilderness. They wandered around lost in the woods for days. And then you get out there in your unit. I was a Confederate, and you march into battle. And in some ways, it's easy to laugh at this hobby, but there are elements of it that I feel do teach you something about war. I was particularly struck by the music and the drill steps that I had learned. It's a way of dealing with the stress of battle, really. You become almost an automaton. You're locked into this unit going right, left, while someone's beating a drum. For me, though, it all sort of fell apart when you get to the shooting part of the battle, because no one wants to die. I mean, you've driven several hours to be there. Who wants to go down in the first 5 minutes? So you have people shooting at each other for, 20 minutes, and finally a commander will say, okay, guys, time to take some hits, and it's kind of all fall down. So the realism kind of slipped away at that point for me.
Who decides who's dead?
Well, they have all kinds of ways of doing it. They recognize that they have this problem, that people don't want to die. So sometimes at the beginning of the reenactment, they'll say, everyone born January through March, you're dead. March through June, serious casualties, or, that sort of thing. It's really an honor system. If someone points a gun right at you and shoots, in theory, you go down.
How long did it take for you to go down?
I was pretty much like everyone else. I wanted to, take part. So maybe after about 20 minutes, my whole unit went down.
How long did you have to play dead?
Not very long. It was towards the end of the battle when we joined it. And what amused me was that they play taps and we get up and, the commander says resurrect. And we would all get up and go and shake hands with the Union dead. And everyone in the audience would cheer. So it was quite a companionable ending to it.
Did you get a sense of what it might have felt like to be on the battlefield, as much as you could get a sense from a reenactment?
Well, again, I think the smoke and noise, and again, the battles that I covered overseas, that's what strikes you, the incredible noise and the smoke and this confusion. And I certainly felt that. We couldn't see a thing at the Wilderness. In fact, we almost fired on the spectators at one point. I think there are aspects of it that you can appreciate. But again, what really defines war, I think, is the experience of risking death. And since that's not a part of it, I think that that's quite an obstacle.
Did the whole reenactment seem particularly strange to you because you had covered real battles abroad?
Well, again, yes, because I think the kind of tragedy and brutality has been drained out of it, and it's really this sort of reenactment of really just the spectacle and the glamour of war, almost without the grisliness. The other thing that's rather odd is that almost everyone wants to play a rebel, even if they're from the North. So, as you may know, in the actual war at the Battle of Wilderness and most others, the North massively outnumbered the South. But in reenactments, it's usually the opposite. So you have a historical problem. You're trying to reenact, say, Pickett's Charge, and you've got 10,000 screaming rebels and 500 beleaguered bluecoats who are somehow supposed to emerge victorious, and that's a little hard to do. And sometimes, in fact, people playing rebels will go a little further and sort of try and, you know, rewrite history. I mean, just because it's the lost cause doesn't mean you have to keep losing it forever.
Why do more people want to be rebels? Is it because they're Southern? More Southerners participate?
No, many of them are Northerners. And I think this is a complex and interesting question. You know, I think, one, there's this sort of instinctive allegiance that Americans have to the underdogs, and at least militarily, the South was the underdog. I think it speaks more broadly to the romance of the South. You know, sort of conformist ranks of blue can't compete with these doomed cavaliers who are somehow very romantic, Ashley Wilkes and Jeb Stuart. But I think there's also a really serious question here. You know, from about fifth grade on, we're always told that the winners write the history. And in the case of the Civil War, I'm not sure that's true. I think the South lost the war, but in some ways it's won the history, or at least fought it to a draw. And I think that's reflected in the great romance surrounding the South still.
Did you bring up the slavery question with white people who were dressing as Confederates? I mean, how did they feel fighting for the side that supported the continuation of slavery?
Well, again, there's this curious sort of suspension of belief that goes on with reenactments. What reenactors will say to you is that we're not here to debate the issues of the war. We're here to reenact the experience of the common soldier, North or South, their valor, their sacrifice, their suffering, and we're not here to debate ideology. And one of the things I found odd about this is they are so well informed about the minutiae of battle. For instance, they can tell you how many men were killed in their unit in each battle and exactly what they ate and what they wore. But when it comes to the issues surrounding the war, their memory just really isn't so strong. They just really aren't very interested in a way, or they just want to set it aside so that they can have this this event that's free of ideology.
Well, after one of the reenactments in which you were dressed as a Confederate soldier, you went to a 7-Eleven and ran into some African-Americans who were shopping there. And how did it feel to be dressed, you know, as a rebel, as the side that was supporting slavery?
Right.
You know, running into African-Americans.
Well, this was a sobering thing for me, because somehow in the course of the weekend, you really are just play acting. It's almost a carnival atmosphere that you dress up and you inhabit another role. You become someone else for a day. And it is just play acting. No one's there talking about the causes of the war. And I realized that this really isn't something you can play act and somehow just leave the issues behind, as much as reenactors want to do it. You know, there are some really unresolved issues surrounding the Civil War. And if you're going to reenact it, you need to face those honestly as well.
You asked a very good and provocative question to a young African-American preacher. You asked if there was any way for white Southerners to honor their forebears without insulting his. What was his response?
His response was, fine, remember the war, warts and all. I guess what offends him is this attempt to make heroes out of Southern generals and other figures. And his attitude was, if you're going to remember it, remember the bad as well. And then maybe, you know, I'll take part. A black woman said something else to me that stuck with me. She said, they can remember that war all they want as long as they remember they lost.
If you're just joining us, we're listening back to my 1998 interview with Tony Horowitz, who died Monday at the age of 60. We'll hear more of the conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Capital One. Capital One wants to build a better bank, one that feels and acts nothing like a typical bank. So they're reimagining banking. They offer a great savings rate and accounts with no fees or minimums that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. That's banking reimagined. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I mark it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years?
Oh, I still think about it every time I see his face.
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.
Journalist and author Tony Horowitz died Monday at age 60. We're listening back to my 1998 interview with him about his book, Confederates in the Attic, Dispatches from the Unfinished Civil War. It's about how the war is in some ways still being fought, including in reenactments of famous battles.
You know, I've never really quite understood the obsession that some people still have with the Civil War, but I always figured that must have something to do with the fact that my grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. They didn't get here until after the Civil War. So the war has no direct ancestral connection for me. But on the other hand, your great-grandfather, who was also an Eastern European immigrant, came to America, lived in the North, and became very absorbed in Civil War history. What was the nature of his interest in the Civil War?
Well, in a way, this is what got me started over 30 years ago. I was very fortunate in that my great-grandfather lived to be over 100, so I knew him as a child. And one day he took out this quite fantastic book of Civil War sketches that he had purchased soon after arriving from Russia in 1882. And it really drew me into the Civil War. And it wasn't really till years later that I started thinking about this. And I said, why an immigrant who spoke almost no English, who arrived here as a teenage draft dodger from the Tsar's army, you know, what was it about this war that intrigued him so much? And, you know, no one ever thought to ask him. I have a few ideas, but, you know, I can't really answer that question. But I think there are millions like myself who have no ancestral or really regional ties to the war, yet we're fascinated by it.
So what are your ideas about why your great-grandfather was fascinated by the Civil War?
Well, there's a very thoughtful essay that Robert Penn Warren wrote called The Legacy of the Civil War that, to my mind, is still one of the best things written on the subject. And he talks about the Civil War being the ritual of becoming American, that somehow understanding this great conflict is part of how you feel and become American. And I think perhaps, particularly for my great-grandfather, arriving only 17 years after the end of the war, he came from learned rabbinical stock, and I think perhaps he saw the Civil War as a sort of Talmud that would unlock the secrets of this country that he'd come to and make him feel more American.
You know, it's funny. I think one of the things that continues to separate the North and the South is the Civil War, in the sense that I think many more Southerners are obsessed with the Civil War in a way that Northerners are not. Do you agree?
Well, oh, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of the premise of my book, is that, you know, the war is still going on. Some Southerners, and I don't mean to suggest by any means most Southerners, but a strong subculture, are really still fighting this war by other means. It's not military anymore, but it's still going on. And I think there are all kinds of reasons for this, some of them quite obvious. You know, one out of every three Confederate soldiers died in this war. You know, the casualties, a million people, there were a million casualties in this war at a time when this country only had 32, 33 million people. So if you adjust that for today's population, you're talking about 8 million casualties. And in the South, it was much more severe than in the North. So I don't think this is something people forget quickly. Also, as Shelby Foote has often pointed out, you remember your losses much more than your victories. Winners tend to kind of win and move on. And I think when you lose, there's a sting there, a need to explain it and justify it that continues.
Now I have to ask you a pop culture question. What are some of your favorite movies or books about the Civil War?
I have to say I find most of the movies pretty dreadful. I think Glory comes the closest to conveying the experience of Civil War combat much more successfully, say, than Gettysburg does. In terms of books, Cold Mountain, obviously, though it's not about Civil War combat, really, I think gives an incredibly rich and true and historically correct image of what life was like in the 1860s South. I'm very fond of things that were written quite a while ago. Robert Penn Warren, Walker Percy, Edmund Wilson wrote a very fine book during the centennial about the war that I think still stands up very well. It has a wonderful line about why it is we still remember the war, and he says America has forgotten all its wars and it's tried to forget the Civil War, but the enemy is still on the premises and he won't let us forget it.
And what do you think of Gone with the Wind?
Well, Gone with the Wind, again, I think speaks to this issue of the South, in some sense, winning the history of the war. I think it's obvious that Gone with the Wind has done more than any of the 60,000-plus history books written about the Civil War to shape popular notions about the war. I think the novel is quite wonderful, and if you read it carefully, you realize she's by no means an apologist for the lost cause. She's got a lot of scorn for it. I think the movie glossed over that and really created this very soft focus image of the antebellum South, and I'm less fond of that.
Well, Tony Horowitz, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
My interview with Tony Horowitz was recorded in 1998 after the publication of his book Confederates in the Attic. He died Monday, just a couple of weeks after the publication of his new book, Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. We'll hear Maureen Corrigan's review of that book after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from E-Trade. With all the jargon, investing can feel like a foreign language. E-Trade makes investing simple by providing personalized support and guidance in terms you can understand. They let you get started in the market with as little as $500 and then help you learn as you go. You don't need to be a pro to invest at E-Trade. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
After James Reeb was murdered in 1965, there was a national outcry.
But back at the scene of the crime in Selma, Alabama, many people responded differently.
So what happened then? And what could justice look like all these years later?
NPR's new podcast, White Lies, is seeking answers. Listen and subscribe now.
We're remembering journalist Tony Horowitz, who died Monday at age 60. Throughout his career, Horowitz covered national news, as well as wars and conflicts in the Middle East, Africa, and Eastern Europe. For the last decade or so, Horowitz trained his expert eye on the conflicts ranging in this country, and this month, he published a new book called Spying on the South. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviewed that book on Fresh Air last week. Here's that review.
I've been waiting for Tony Horowitz to write another big, on-the-road book that crisscrosses the American cultural divide ever since his bestseller, Confederates in the Attic, came out in 1998. For those who haven't read it, Confederates in the Attic is a revelatory and very funny first-person travelogue in which Horowitz roams the South, talking to battlefield reenactors and members of the Daughters of the Confederacy in order to grasp what he calls America's unfinished Civil War. Now Horowitz is back, exploring what critic Greil Marcus famously referred to as the old weird America in his new book called Spying on the South. This time, though, he's not traveling alone. His ghostly companion is Frederick Law Olmsted, the great 19th-century landscape architect, best known for designing New York's Central Park. Spying on the South opened my eyes to so many things, starting with the figure of Olmsted himself. It turns out that as a young man, Olmsted was monumentally unfocused, dabbling in professions like merchant seamen and farming. His deliverance came in the form of a job offer in 1852 from the paper that would become the New York Times. Olmsted's assignment was to roam the antebellum South as an undercover correspondent. He set out on two journeys that lasted years, the second one taking him as far west as Texas. Eventually, Olmsted wrote some 64 dispatches for the Times, as well as three books. But the most unexpected and powerful legacy of Olmsted's travels was Central Park itself. The aristocratic Southern slaveholders he'd met had insisted to Olmsted that Northern society was every bit as hierarchical and closed as the South's. In answer, Olmsted created a people's park designed to be democratically open to all. Some 160 years after Olmsted set out on the old B&O Railroad, Horowitz tells us he stepped aboard Amtrak. No bookings, no itinerary, just a ramble across America with long-dead Fred as my guide. Horowitz spends his first night on the road, as Olmsted did, in the town of Cumberland, Maryland, which Olmsted described as comfortless. Nevertheless, back then, the town was a major transportation hub, billed as the gateway to the West. These days, a Cumberland Tavern owner tells Horwitz that the major industry is locking people up in the area's 8 correctional facilities. That first night in Cumberland sets the pattern for how Horwitz's impressions will contrast with Olmsted's. For the mostly white, working-class Americans Horwitz meets, the old promise of something better waiting beyond the horizon has been exhausted. Aboard a coal barge he rides down the Ohio River, Horwitz talks to a first mate who tells him that the barge offers a good living for country boys, a place you can still work from the neck down. But that coal barge is a slow-moving relic of America's industrial past. The small-town present that Horwitz travels through is a landscape dominated by abandoned storefronts, rehab centers, and wheezing businesses like the Cheapo Depot. Horwitz rightly prides himself on being a curious and empathetic freestyle conversationalist, a gift that Olmsted apparently shared. Traveling south and west by car, steamboat, and even mule in advance of the 2016 primary season, Horwitz wants to gauge what Olmsted called the drift of things in America. What he hears at almost every restaurant, bar, plantation house tour, and town hall meeting is an earful about big government, gun rights, and the fallacy of climate change, as well as disgust with handout Democrats. He also hears uglier views, like in Crockett, Texas, where white members of the Moosehead Lodge are convinced, even against the word of the local sheriff, that a big, gated property owned by a South Asian doctor is really a terrorist training camp. Horwitz leaves Crockett with his faith in the illuminating power of fact shaken. Spying on the South is every bit as enlightening and alive with detail, absurdity, and colorful characters as Confederates in the Attic was. That said, though, at a time when the American divide seems deeper and more entrenched, both books strike me as more somber than comic. Horwitz tells us that he began his travels identifying with Olmsted's missionary spirit, believing that there was always room for dialogue and great value in having it, if only to make it harder for Americans to demonize each other. At Journey's End, however, the earnest Horwitz finds himself all talked out. In a rainy Central Park, he tells us he walked from one end of Olmsted's great park to another, unaccustomedly alone with my thoughts.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new book Spying on the South by Tony Horwitz. He died Monday at age 60. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak. We'll talk about the court's direction on abortion, the role the court might play in congressional committee subpoenas that President Trump is resisting, and how the court is changing with Trump's 2 appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.